Whether patients can afford food, heat, clothing, or their medications has a big effect on their health. But asking patients about personal difficulties and looking for solutions is part of the training for very few doctors. One exception is at Boston Medical Center, where many of the city's low and moderate income residents go for care. It's beginning to teach residents to ask patients whether they have the means to get or stay healthy. WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports.
It's day two of orientation for new residents at Boston Medical Center. There's an additional workshop in the program this year, a short series of videos that highlight what BMC says is a problem in medicine.
Hi, I'm Dr. Toon. So what's bringing you to the ER today?
Just got this throbbing headache.
Have you tried anything medicine-wise to make the headache feel better?
No, says the patient, but he does have a prescription for a blood pressure medication.
How often would you say you take this medicine?
Whenever I can.
So how often is that?
Whenever I can.
Okay, fair enough.
The resident checks the patient's heart rate, breathing, and some other things, then excuses himself to consult with a senior emergency room doctor. The video screen goes black.
What was lacking? What was missing in that interaction?
Travis Manasco, a fourth-year resident who's leading this workshop, looks around a table of 14 new doctors in this stark white conference room. Josh Minsky noticed that the resident did not ask why the patient isn't taking his medicine as prescribed.
He really delved into the issue with the hypertensive meds, where he kind of, the patient seemed like he, you know, isn't taking it as it's prescribed. And he didn't really kind of delve in at all. He was like, why can't we get the meds in you on a normal schedule? What's the problem? Try to evaluate that a little bit.
I agree. Can we do the next video, please?
On screen, the senior physician listens to the resident's summary of his patient and has some questions.
Okay, all right. I was just wondering, why is his blood pressure out of control?
He's supposed to be taking amlodipine, and, look at his encounter history. No-show, canceled, no-show, no-show.
But why?
I don't know.
That's a response organizers of this workshop do not want to hear anymore. Turns out this patient says he often has to choose between paying for his medication and feeding his kids. He misses appointments when they conflict with work. But can doctors fix these problems even if they have the time, asks resident Katrina Seraldo.
It feels like we don't have the tools for that, even though we probably do at this hospital.
I think it's also like sort of unclear, or maybe there's a fuzzy line between things that we should be trying to tackle on our own and when we should ask for help.
That's Michelle Zhang, who's told never be afraid to ask for help. Boston Medical Center, the largest so-called safety net hospital in New England, has a food pantry, legal aid, housing assistance, and a dozen other programs outside the scope of traditional health care. But even here, would every supervising physician ask a resident to find out why a patient isn't taking their medicine?
Nope, not at all. But I think it won't be long before this thing will catch on.
Dr. Thea James is the emergency room physician you heard in the video. James created this workshop about what are known as social determinants of health. It's a recognition that where and how people live, their cultural or religious beliefs, their education and income, all of these things affect health. Most medical schools focus on the biology of health. Dr. Jeff Schneider, who oversees training programs at BMC, added this workshop to resident orientation to emphasize the need for a cultural shift among doctors.
As important as checking their blood pressure is probably trying to figure out why their blood pressure is poorly controlled. It's as important as anything else that you're going to do.
Boston Medical Center and other hospitals are trying to figure out if it makes sense to pay for medications or heat or food or housing, things patients need to stay healthy. James says that may be the only way to break a cycle of mind-numbing headaches, asthma attacks, chest pains, and all the related costs for patients and hospitals.
The patients will get a higher quality of care and have a greater opportunity to have a great life and to thrive, and the medical institutions will do better financially as well.
There are a few similar training programs for medical students and residents at hospitals around the country. A requirement that nursing schools teach students to assess social and cultural factors that affect a patient's health started in 2008. As many experts try to figure out why the U.S. spends more than any other country in the world on healthcare, but is far from having the best results, there's growing interest in looking outside the traditional medical toolbox. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
The Massachusetts House and Senate are expected to formally approve a compromise version of a transgender rights bill today and then send it to Governor Baker. The measure would ensure that transgender people have access to public accommodations such as locker rooms and restrooms. Critics have argued that predators might pose as transgender women, and the measure could end up putting women and children at risk. To address those concerns, the bill asks the state attorney general to provide some guidance. When we talked with her this morning, we started by asking State Attorney General Maura Healey how her office is going to define and determine when someone might assert gender identity for improper use.
It's actually pretty straightforward and relatively simple. The fact of the matter is 17 other states and over 200 cities across this country already have these protections in place. And basically, what the law is going to do is to say, treat people as they present, as they wish to be treated. Treat them with respect and with dignity. Respect their gender identity. Specifically, it means that they can't be discriminated against, they can't be harassed, they can't be asked to leave because they are transgender. And really, this is about what an individual, their belief, their feeling of who they are fundamentally in their gender identity. And that's what the law calls upon businesses and other places of public accommodation to respect. It's as simple as that. I'll point that out in contrast to what's happening right now in North Carolina, which is really outrageous, where people are now being told that they cannot use a bathroom unless their birth certificate basically shows that they are of a particular biological sex.
Will your office also be looking into other things such as, providing guidance to businesses?
The nice thing here is that for the last few years now, businesses have already had to comply with this law when it comes to their businesses as a place of employment. This has actually been the law. I think that's why you saw overwhelming support from the business community to close this gap and to ensure that we also have a law that protects transgender people from discrimination in places of public accommodation. Businesses are already doing this for their employees, and this is not going to be a change in the way they do, the way they conduct their business. We will continue to act as an office to further educate the public, including businesses, about what needs to happen and stand ready to work with them so that they understand what really are appropriate and non-discriminatory conduct when it comes to serving customers and serving members of the public.
Now, Governor Baker had said that he did want to make sure that your office was weighing in here about exactly how to make sure that the law wasn't used inappropriately. Do you feel that the provision that's in this compromise so far is enough to satisfy the governor and that this bill will go forward and go forward quickly?
Well, I'm delighted to see this bill come out of the conference committee. I applaud the House and the Senate for their leadership. This is an important civil rights issue, and I hope that the governor signs this bill as soon as it gets to his desk. It's really, really important for transgender people. It's really important for families of transgender people, particularly the many families of transgender children. I've spent a lot of time with them over the last couple of years and listening to them, and, it is so important that they no longer feel that their child is going to grow up in a world where they face stigma, they face real threats of violence or discrimination. This is about civil rights. This is about equality. This is where we need to be. And I'm delighted to see this bill move forward through leadership in the legislature. And my hope is that it will be signed into law right away.
Okay. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Weeks after securing their title, the 2016 NBA champion Golden State Warriors appear to be an even stronger team thanks to the addition of a superstar. Forward Kevin Durant disappointed fans of the Oklahoma City Thunder by leaving the team that made him a star for a lucrative deal with the Warriors. Commentator Bill Littlefield's been watching some of the more extreme ways that fans of the Thunder are expressing their disappointment.
No NBA team has ever been quite as successful as the 2015-16 Warriors were during the regular season. This week's edition of Kevin Durant should make them even better. But the subtraction of Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder has upset fans there at least as much as his switch to the Warriors has delighted Golden State fans. People in Oklahoma City burned Durant's jersey. One guy went further. He blew up Durant's jersey with an explosive charge and posted the carnage on the internet. A fellow known as Big Rich, who owns a bar in Oklahoma City, defaced the for sale sign outside Durant's home by printing the word coward in large letters across it. A guy with an especially twisted sense of humor told his young son that his favorite player was leaving town and then put the video of the kid in tears on YouTube. Rooting for a team is an emotional experience, but that's not the way it works for the players. Once lots of pro athletes were connected to the teams employing them by reserve clauses or territorial rights rules, but those days are long gone. The best contemporary players are mercenaries. Some of them change teams to get more money, some jump for what they feel is a better opportunity to win a championship. But what the great and the not-so-great players have in common is something that lots of fans lack. Mobility. It comes with a job description. It doesn't always work to the benefit of the players. Sometimes they get traded to places they'd rather not go. And sometimes they attain free agency and get to find out who wants them and for how much. When people call such a player a traitor, a coward, or as one writer called LeBron James when he jumped to Miami after the 2010 season, the whore of Akron, they ascribe their own passions to the player. He doesn't share them. This is not to say players have no sense of community. Kevin Durant is reported to have been a generous benefactor to Oklahoma City. One presumes he'll do good works in Oakland, which, like the rest of the communities in which the NBA does business, could use lots of help off the court. I don't think the news of that likelihood will comfort immediately that crying child people have seen in the video. But if he grows up to be a more rational fan than his father is, maybe one day it'll make him feel better. Maybe he'll even forgive his father.
Bill Littlefield comments on sports for WBUR and hosts Only a Game each Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.